free to walk the streets terrifies me. I would feel terrified just knowing he was out there. This last point is something D.I. Clark has hinted I should include. It's all very well for Nelson's lawyer to argue that her client has no intention of approaching me. If I feel threatened by the very fact of his freedom, there's a risk I might withdraw my testimony and the trial would collapse. Right now, I'm the most important person in this courtroom. Both magistrates are still watching me. The public gallery, too, is silent. Before I started, I was nervous, but now I feel powerful and in control. Dion Nelson didn't just rape me, I say. He made me live with the fear he was going to send the video of what he'd done to everyone I know. Threats and intimidation are how he works. I hope the justice system will treat his bail application accordingly.
Bravo,
a little voice inside my head says. Thank you, Miss Matthews. We will certainly take your views into very serious consideration, the male magistrate says kindly. Feel free to take a moment to sit down in the witness box if you wish. Then, when you're feeling well enough, you may go. There's silence in the courtroom as I gather up my things. Nelson's lawyer is already on her feet, waiting to approach the bench.
Now, Jane.
What do you mean, danger?
I'm smiling at the ludicrousness of what she's just said. But Carol Janssen, I can see, is deadly serious. Not from Edward, surely.
Emma told me.
Carol stops and frowns, as if breaking this taboo doesn't come easily to her. As a therapist, I spend most of my time unpicking unconscious patterns of behavior. When someone asks me, "Why are all men like that?" my answer is, "Why are all the men you choose like that?" Freud talks about something he called repetition compulsion, that is, a pattern in which someone acts out the same sexual psychodrama over and over again, with different people allotted the same unchanging roles. At a subconscious or even a conscious level, they're hoping to rewrite the outcome, to perfect whatever it was that went wrong before. Inevitably, though, the same flaws and imperfections they themselves bring to the relationship destroy it in exactly the same way.
How does this relate to Emma and me? I say, although I've already started to guess.
In any relationship, there are two repetition compulsions at work, his and hers. Their interaction may be benign, or it may be destructive, horribly destructive. Emma had low self-esteem that was lowered still further when she was sexually assaulted. Like many rape victims, she blamed herself, quite wrongly, of course. In Edward Monkford, she found someone who would give her the abuse she at some level craved.
Wait a minute, I say, shocked. Edward, an abuser? Have you met him?
Carol shakes her head. I'm going by what I gleaned from Emma, which, by the way, was no easy matter. She was always reluctant to be open with me, a classic sign of low self-esteem.
It simply isn't possible, I say flatly. I do know Edward. He'd never hit anyone.
Not all abuse is physical, Carol says quietly. The need for absolute control is another kind of ill treatment.
Absolute control.
The words hit me like a slap, because I can see that, viewed a certain way, they fit. Edward's behavior seemed reasonable enough to Emma so long as she colluded with it. That is, so long as she allowed him to control her, Carol continues. There were things that should have served as warning signs. The strange setup with the house, the way he made even small decisions for her, or separated her from her friends and family. all the classic behaviors of the narcissistic sociopath. But the real problems started when she tried to break away from him. Sociopath. I know professionals don't use that term quite the same way the general public does, but even so, I can't help thinking of what Emma's previous boyfriend, Simon Wakefield, Carol had called him, said that time outside the house. First he poisoned her mind, then he killed her. Does any of what I'm describing sound familiar, Jane? She prompts. I don't answer her directly. What happened to Emma? After all this other stuff, I mean. Eventually, with my help, she started to realize how destructive the relationship with Edward Monkford had become. She broke up with him, but it left her depressed and withdrawn, paranoid even. She pauses. That was when she broke off contact with me. Hang on, I say, puzzled. How do you know he killed her then? Carol Janssen frowns. I didn't say he killed her, Jane. Oh, I say, relieved. So what are you saying? Her depression, her paranoia, the negative feelings and low self-esteem the relationship had fostered. To my mind, these were undoubtedly contributory factors. You think it was suicide? That was my professional opinion. Yes. I think Emma threw herself down the stairs at a time when she was suffering from extreme depression. I'm silent, thinking. Tell me about your own relationship with Edward, Carol suggests. Well, that's the strange thing. From the sound of it, there aren't really many similarities. It started not long after I'd moved in. He made it very clear that he wanted me, but also that he wasn't offering a conventional relationship. He said, Wait, Carol interrupts. I'm just going to get something. She leaves the room and after a short time comes back with a red notebook. The notes from my sessions with Emma, she explains, leafing through the pages. You were saying? He said there's a kind of purity to the unencumbered affair. Carol finishes for me. Yes. I stare at her. Those were his exact words. Words he'd previously spoken to someone else, it would appear. From what Emma told me, Edward is an extreme, almost obsessive perfectionist. Would you agree with that? I nod reluctantly. But of course, our previous relationships can't ever be perfected, no matter how many times we act them out. Each successive failure simply reinforces the maladaptive behavior. In other words, the pattern becomes more pronounced over time, as well as more desperate. Can't a person change? Oddly enough, Emma asked me the exact same question. Carol thinks for a moment. Sometimes, yes, but it's a painful and difficult process, even with the help of a good therapist. And it's narcissistic to believe that we're going to be the one to change another person's fundamental nature. The only person you can ever really change is yourself. You say I'm in danger of going the same way as her, I object. But from what you describe, she was nothing like me. Perhaps, but you've told me that you suffered a stillbirth. It's striking, isn't it, that you were both in some way damaged when he met you. Sociopaths are attracted to the vulnerable. Why did Emma stop seeing you? A look of regret crosses Carol's face. I don't know. If she'd only stayed in therapy, perhaps she'd still be alive today. She had your card with her, I say. I found her sleeping bag in the attic at 1 Folgate Street, along with some cans of food.
It looked like she'd been sleeping up there. She must have been planning to call you. She nods slowly. I suppose that's something. Thank you.
But I don't think you're right about everything else. If Emma was depressed, it was because the affair with Edward was over, not because he was controlling her. And if she killed herself, well, that's horribly sad, but it's hardly his fault. As you said yourself, we all have to take responsibility for our own actions.
Carol only smiles sadly and shakes her head. I get the impression she's heard something similar before, perhaps even from Emma. Suddenly, I've had enough of this room, with its soft furnishings and its clutter, its cushions and tissues and psychobabble. I stand. Thank you for seeing me. It's been interesting, but I don't think I want to talk to you about my daughter after all. Or about Edward. I won't be coming back.
Then, Emma. I can't go to the public gallery after reading out my impact statement because of the special measures, so I hang around outside the court waiting. It's not long before D.I. Clark and Sergeant Willen rush out looking troubled. With them is the lawyer for the prosecution, Mr. Broom. Emma, come this way, Sergeant Willen goes. Why? What's going on? I say as they whisk me off to another part of the lobby. I look back at the courtroom doors just as Nelson's lawyer emerges. With her is a dark-skinned teenager in a suit. He turns in my direction, and I see a flash of recognition in his eyes. Then his lawyer says something and he turns back to her. Emma, the magistrates have granted bail, Sergeant Willen is saying. I'm sorry. What? I say, bewildered. Why? The magistrates agreed with Mrs. Fields, the defense counsel, that there were some difficulties with our case. Difficulties? What does that mean? I say. From another door, the one leading to the public gallery, Simon appears. He makes a beeline for me. Procedural difficulties, D.I. Clark says grimly, principally around the issue of identification. No DNA, you mean? And no fingerprints, the barrister says. D.I. Clark doesn't look at him. At the time, of course, there was no allegation of rape. It was classified as a break-in. A decision was made by the duty officer not to dust for prints. He sighs. And then later, we should probably have put Nelson into a lineup. But since you told us he was wearing a balaclava, there didn't seem much point. Unfortunately, a clever lawyer can use that sort of thing to imply the police have been jumping to conclusions. But if that's the problem, why don't I do a lineup now? I say. Clark and the lawyer exchange glances. It might help when it comes to trial, the lawyer says thoughtfully. This is very important, Emma, D.I. Clark says. Have you at any point during the proceedings today caught sight of the defendant? I shake my head. After all, I don't know for sure that was Nelson I saw. And even if it was, why should he get off just because the police are so incompetent? I think we should consider it, the lawyer says, nodding. Emma, Simon calls, desperate to break into the conversation. Emma, I know you meant it. Meant what? I say. That it was only because of that bastard we split up. What? No, I say, shaking my head. That was for the court, Si. I didn't... I'm not going back. Emma, Edward's voice says, calm and authoritative behind us. I turn to him gratefully. Well done, he says. You were brilliant. He enfolds me in his arms, and I see Simon's horror as he realizes what this means. Jesus, he whispers. Jesus, Emma, you can't be. Can't what, Simon? I say defiantly. Can't choose who I go out with. The police officers and Broom, aware they're present at some personal drama, look down and shuffle their feet. As usual, Edward takes charge. Come with me, he says. He puts his arm around me and steers me away. I glance back once and see Simon staring after us, mute with misery and anger.
Now, Jane. That weekend, Edward takes me to the British Museum, where an assistant unlocks a cabinet and leaves us alone to examine a small prehistoric sculpture. The carving has been smoothed by time, but it's still recognizably two lovers entwined. It's 11,000 years old, the oldest depiction of sex in the world, Edward says, from a civilization known as the Natufians, the first people to create communities. It's hard to concentrate. I can't stop thinking about the fact he spoke the exact same words to Emma as he did to me. Some of Carol's other comments I can disregard, given that she never met Edward, but the hard evidence of her notebook is more difficult to ignore. But then, I think, we're all guilty of dropping into the same familiar phrases, the same linguistic shortcuts. We all tell the same anecdotes to different people, sometimes even the same people, often in the same words. Who doesn't repeat themselves sometimes? Aren't repetition compulsion and acting out just fancy terms for being creatures of habit? Then Edward passes me the carving to hold, and immediately all my attention is focused on that. I find myself thinking how incredible it is that people have been making love for so many millennia. But of course, it's one of the few constants of mankind's history. The same act repeated through the generations. Afterward, I ask if we can go and see the Elgin Marbles, but Edward doesn't want to. The public galleries will be full of tourists. Besides, I make it a rule only to look at one thing in a museum. Any more, and your brain gets overloaded. He starts to walk back the way we came. Carol Janssen's words come back to me. Edward's behavior seemed reasonable enough to Emma so long as she colluded with it. That is, so long as she allowed him to control her. I stop dead. Edward, I really want to see them. He looks at me, puzzled. All right, but not now. I'll make an arrangement with the director. We can come back when the museum's closed. Now, I say, it has to be now. I'm aware I sound childish and stressed. An assistant looks up from a desk and frowns. Edward shrugs. Very well. He leads me through a different door into the public part of the museum. People surge around the exhibits like fish feeding on coral. Edward cuts through them without a sideways glance. In here, he says. This room is even busier, packed with school kids holding clipboards and chattering away in French. Then there are the culture zombies, nodding along to their audio guides. The couples clutching at each other's hands who drift around the room like dragnets. The buggy pushers, the backpackers, the selfie takers. And beyond all that, behind a metal rail, some plinths bearing a few fragments of battered sculpture and the famous frieze. It's hopeless. I try to look at them properly, but the magic I felt holding that tiny, millennia-old carving in my hands is nowhere to be found. You were right, I say miserably. This is hideous. He smiles. They're unexciting at the best of times. If it weren't for the fuss about ownership, nobody would give them a second glance. Even the building they came from, the Parthenon, is as dull as ditchwater. Ironically enough, it was built as a symbol of the power of Greek empire, so it's only appropriate that another greedy empire should have stolen bits of it. Shall we go? We drop by his office to pick up a leather overnight bag, then a fishmonger's, where Edward has pre-ordered the ingredients for a stew. The man is apologetic. One of the fish on Edward's list was hake, but he's had to substitute monkfish.
Same price, of course, sir, although we normally charge more for the monk.
Edward shakes his head.
The recipe requires hake. What can I do, sir?
The fishmonger spreads his hands.
If they don't catch it, we can't sell it.
Are you telling me, Edward says slowly, that there was no hake at all at Billingsgate this morning?
Only for silly money.
Then why didn't you pay it?
The man's smile is faltering.
Monkfish is better, sir.
I ordered hake, Edward says. You've let me down. I won't be coming back.
He turns on his heel and stalks out. The fishmonger shrugs and goes back to the fish he was filleting. But not before he's given me a curious look. I feel my cheeks burning.
Edward's waiting in the street. Let's go, he says, raising his arm for a cab.
One immediately does a U-turn and pulls up next to us. This is a peculiar gift he has, I've noticed. Taxi drivers always seem to have their eyes out for him. I haven't seen him angry before, and I don't know how long his mood will last. But he calmly starts talking about something else, as if the altercation never happened. If Carol was right, and he's a sociopath, wouldn't he be ranting and raving now? It's yet more evidence, I decide, that she was wrong about him. He glances across at me.
I have a feeling you aren't listening, Jane.
Is everything all right?
Oh, sorry, I was miles away. I must try not to let my conversation with the therapist get in the way of the here and now, I decide.
I indicate the overnight bag.
Where are you going?
I thought I might move in with you.
For a moment, I think I can't have heard him right.
Move in?
If you'll have me, of course.
I'm stunned. Edward?
It's too soon.
I've never lived with anyone before.
Because you've never met the right person, he says reasonably.
I understand, Jane. Because I think in some ways we're quite alike. You're private and self-contained and a little bit aloof. It's one of the many things I love about you.
It is, I say, although I'm actually thinking, am I aloof? And did Edward really just say love?
Don't you see? We're perfect for each other.
He touches my hand.
You make me happy, and I think I can make you happy too.
I'm happy now, I say. Edward, you've already made me happy.
And I smile at him, because it's true.
Then, Emma. Next time Edward comes around, he brings a leather overnight bag, along with some fish for a stew. The secret's in the rui, he tells me as he assembles everything on the counter. So many people skimp on the saffron. I have no idea what rui and saffron even are. Are you going somewhere? I ask, looking at the bag. In a way, or rather coming somewhere, if you'll have me, of course. You want to keep a few things here? I say, surprised. No. He says, amused. This is all I own. The bag is as beautiful as everything else he possesses, the leather soft and polished as a horse's saddle. Under the handle is a discreet label embossed with the words, Swain Adeney, Luggage Makers by Royal Appointment. I open it. Inside, everything is as beautifully packed as the engine of a car. I take out the contents one by one, describing them as I go. Half a dozen Comme des Garçons shirts, all white, very well ironed and folded, I might add. Two silk ties from Maison Charvet, a MacBook Air, a leather-bound Fiorentina notebook, a steel propelling pencil, a Hasselblad digital camera, a rolled cotton sleeve containing, let's see, three Japanese knives. Don't touch those, he warns. They're razor sharp. I roll the knives up again and put them to one side. A toiletry bag, 2 black cashmere pullovers, 2 pairs of black trousers, 8 pairs of black socks, 8 pairs of black boxer shorts. Is that really it? Well, I do have a few things at the office, a suit and so on. How do you manage with so little? What else do I need? You haven't answered my question, Emma. It's so sudden, I say, although on the inside I'm somersaulting with joy. You can throw me out any time you want. Why would I want to? It's you who'll get tired of me. I'll never get tired of you, Emma, he says seriously. In you, I think I've finally found the perfect woman. But why? I ask. I don't really get it. I thought we were just having an unencumbered affair, or whatever he called it. Because you never ask questions, he says reasonably. He turns back to the fish. Pass me those knives, will you? Edward! He pretends to sigh. Oh, all right. Because there's something about you, something vibrant and alive, that makes me feel alive as well. Because you're impulsive and extroverted and all the things I'm not. Because you're different from all the other women I've ever known. Because you've rekindled my desire to live. Because you're all I need. Is that enough explanation for you? It'll do for now, I say, unable to keep the smile off my face.
7. Your friend shows you a piece of work she's done. She's clearly proud of it, but it isn't very good. Do you give her an honest, dispassionate critique? Suggest one small improvement to see if she welcomes it. Change the subject. Make vague, encouraging noises. Or tell her she's done really well.
Now, Jane. I have a feeling that what you really want is an apology, the hospital's mediator says. She's a middle-aged woman with a grey woolen cardigan and a careful, sympathetic manner. Is that correct, Jane? Would an acknowledgement by management of everything you've been through help you achieve some closure for your loss? On the other side of the table sits a haggard-looking Dr. Gifford, flanked by a hospital administrator and a solicitor. The mediator, Linda, sits at the end, as if to emphasize her neutrality. Tessa is next to me. Dimly, I manage to grasp that within the space of a single sentence, Linda has already downgraded the offered apology into an acknowledgement of my suffering. A bit like one of those sly politicians' apologies when they say they're sorry if other people are upset. Tessa puts a warning hand on my arm to indicate that she'll take this one. An admission, she says, emphasizing the word fractionally, by the hospital that avoidable errors were indeed made and that these contributed to Isabel's death would of course be welcome, as a first step. Linda sighs, though whether out of professional empathy or because she's realized she has a tricky one on her hands here isn't clear. The hospital's position, correct me if I'm wrong, Derek, is that they would much prefer precious public funds to be spent on treating patients rather than on litigation and lawyers' fees. She turns to the administrator, who nods obligingly. Well, quite, Tessa says reasonably. But if you'd ordered Doppler scans for every expectant mother in the first place, we wouldn't be sitting here today. Instead, someone looked at the figures and calculated that it would be cheaper to pay lawyers' fees and compensation in the small but statistically significant number of cases where it would have made a difference. And until organisations like Still Hope succeed in making that callous, inhumane approach so expensive and so time-consuming that the numbers no longer add up, the situation will continue. Round one to Tessa, I think. Derek, the administrator, speaks. If we have to suspend Mr. Gifford,
which we'll be forced to do if this becomes a formal SUI, his job will be covered by a temporary substitute and more patients will be denied the care of an experienced and respected specialist. SUI? That's a serious untoward incident. Slowly and painfully, I'm becoming familiar with the jargon. Intermittent auscultation, CTG monitoring, partograms, the difference between staffing ratios at the birthing centre where I was and the labour ward proper where I should have been. This meeting was called by the hospital almost as soon as Tessa made a formal request for my medical records. Clearly, they'd been waiting to see if their bland, reassuring letter worked. That in itself, the realization they'd attempted to brush me off and that if it hadn't been for Tessa they'd have succeeded, makes me almost as furious as the waste of Isabel's life. The thing is, Tessa had explained to me on our way to the meeting, if it did come to compensation, this could be an expensive case for them. Why? I know how much payouts for babies who shouldn't have died are. Almost laughably tiny. The actual compensation might not be much, but then there's loss of earnings. You had a well-paid job. If Isabel hadn't died, you'd have taken your maternity leave and gone back to it, yes? I suppose so, but... And now you're working for a stillbirth charity for minimum wage. If we add in the salary you've given up, that's a hefty sum. But that was my choice. A choice you wouldn't have made had circumstances been different. Don't go easy on the hospital, Jane. The more you cost them, the more likely they are to change. She's magnificent, I realise. Strange how you can think you know someone and not really know them at all. In the Still Hope offices, sharing a desk, I'd seen a funny, lively woman with an easy laugh and a penchant for office gossip. Here in this dingy meeting room, I see a seasoned warrior evading the hospital manager's parries with practiced ease. It sounds to me, she says now, as if you're trying to morally blackmail Miss Cavendish by telling her that other babies will die if she pursues her case. Duly noted. But a more responsible position would be to increase staffing levels, not reduce them, at least until the outcome of the SUI review is clear. The faces opposite look at us stonily. Finally, Dr. Gifford speaks. Miss Cavendish, Jane, I just want to say first that I am truly sorry for your loss. And second, I want to apologise for the mistakes that were made. Opportunities to intervene were missed. I can't tell you whether Isabel would be alive today if we'd spotted the problem sooner, but she would certainly have had a better chance. He's speaking to the surface of the table, choosing his words, but now he looks up and meets my gaze. His eyes are bloodshot with fatigue. I was the senior doctor on call. I take full responsibility. There is a long silence. Derek, the administrator, makes a face and throws his hands up in the air, as if to say, now we're screwed. It's Linda who says carefully, well, I think we'll all want a period of time to reflect on that, as well as on all the other good points that have been made today. It was harrowing, I tell Edward later, but not in the way I'd expected. I suddenly realised that if I go ahead with this, I'm going to destroy a man's career, when what happened isn't remotely his fault. I think he's a genuinely nice person.
Perhaps if he wasn't so nice, and his staff were more frightened of him, the midwife would have double-checked the scan in the first place.
I can hardly destroy him for being a kind boss.
Why not? If he's a mediocrity, he deserves it.
I know, of course, that to create buildings as perfect as Edward's requires a certain ruthlessness. He's told me how he once battled the planning authorities for 6 months to avoid putting a smoke alarm on a kitchen ceiling. The planning officer had a nervous breakdown, and Edward got away with no alarm. But I suppose I've never liked to think about that side of him. Unbidden, I hear Carol Janssen's voice. All the traits of the narcissistic sociopath. Tell me about Tessa, Edward suggests, pouring himself some wine. He never fills the glass more than half full, I've noticed. He offers me some, but I shake my head.
She sounds passionate, he comments when I've finished my verbal portrait.
She is. That is, she takes no shit from anybody. But she has a sense of humor, too.
And what does she think about your Dr. Gifford?
She thinks his speech was scripted, I admit. It's the difference between responsibility and liability, Jane, she'd told me afterward, over biscuits and lattes in Starbucks, between one doctor's mistake and an organization's institutional failures. They'll do anything they can to keep the hospital management out of it. So now, you have to decide whether you want your dead daughter to become part of this woman's personal crusade, Edward says thoughtfully. I look at him, surprised. You think I should drop it?
Well, it's your decision, of course, but your friend certainly seems intent on fighting this battle at any cost.
I consider. It's true. I'm fairly sure that in Tessa I have made a friend. I enjoy her company, but most of all I admire her toughness. I want her to like me back, and, of course, if I were to withdraw from the case, I might forfeit that. Separating Emma from her friends and family. You don't have a problem with that, do you? I say.
Of course not, he says easily. I just want you to be happy, that's all.
Incidentally, I'm going to change this sofa. Why? The sofa is beautiful, a long, low expanse of heavy cream linen.
Now I'm living here, I've noticed a few things that could be better, that's all.
The cutlery, for example. I don't know what I was thinking of when I chose the Jean Nouvel, and I think the sofa invites us to slouch.
Really, two armchairs would be better. Le Corbusier's LC3, perhaps. Or the ghost chair by Philippe Starck.
I'll give it some more thought. Already, in the short time since Edward has moved in, I've noticed a difference. Not so much in my relationship with him, as in my relationship with 1 Folgate Street. That feeling I used to have of playing to an invisible audience has been replaced by the consciousness, the ever-presence of Edward's discerning eye. A sense that the house and I are now part of 1 indivisible mise-en-scène. I feel my life becoming more considered, more beautiful, knowing that he considers it. But for that very reason, it becomes increasingly hard to engage with the world beyond these walls, the world where chaos and ugliness reign. When choosing cutlery is this difficult, how will I ever decide whether or not to sue a hospital? Anything else? I ask. Edward thinks. We need to be more disciplined about putting away toiletries. This morning, for example, I noticed you left your shampoo out. I know, I forgot.
Well, don't beat yourself up. It takes discipline to live like this. But I think you're already discovering that the rewards are worth it.
Then, Emma. I'd been dreading the identification parade. I'd been imagining me and Dion Nelson eyeball to eyeball as I walked slowly along a line of men in a small, bright room, like in the movies. But of course it's nothing like that these days. This is Viper, D.I. Clark informs me genially as he puts 2 mugs of coffee down next to his laptop. Short for Video Identification Parade Electronic Recording, apparently, though if you ask me, Someone at the Home Office just figured a sexy acronym would help it catch on quicker. Basically, we put the suspect on video, then the system uses facial recognition software to find 8 other people from its library who look quite like him. It used to take weeks to set up an ID before we had this. Let's get started, shall we? He takes some documents from a plastic sleeve. Before we start, he says apologetically, you'll need to sign some forms to say you've only ever seen the accused when the alleged offence was taking place. Of course, I say airily. Do you have a pen? The thing is, Emma, he says, looking a little uncomfortable, it's very important that you're absolutely certain you couldn't have caught sight of him at the bail hearing. Not that I'm aware of, I say, then mentally kick myself. If I'm saying I remember Nelson from the assault well enough to make a positive ID, then of course I ought to know if I saw him anywhere else, but D.I. Clark doesn't appear to have noticed my slip. Of course, I believe you completely, but you should be aware, because it may come up at trial, that the defendant is alleging you and he exchanged a glance, as it were, outside the court. Well, that's nonsense, I say. Furthermore, his lawyer is saying he remarked on it at the time. She says she looked up and saw you passing within 15 feet of her client. I frown. I don't think so, I say. Yes. Well, it's made the lawyer fairly agitated anyway. A formal complaint plus notification that, witness veracity will be an issue at the trial. Witness veracity, I repeat. Whether I'm telling the truth, you mean? I'm afraid so. She may try to put this together with the whole amnesia thing. I'll be frank with you, Emma. It's not the nicest experience when a tricky defense lawyer tries to pick holes in your story. But that is her job. And forewarned is forearmed, yes? Just stick to exactly what happened, and you'll be fine. I sign the forms, identify Nelson, and walk home, seething. So now I'm going to be attacked in court by a lawyer bent on undermining my story. I have a horrible feeling that by trying to make up for the police's failures, I may have made things a whole lot worse. I'm so wrapped up in my thoughts that at first I don't notice the kid on the BMX bike, who's slowed to walking pace beside me. When I do become aware of him, I see it's a teenager, about 14 or 15 years old. Instinctively, I move away, as close as possible to the wall. Effortlessly, he rides the bike up over the curb. I try to duck back the way I came, but he's a little behind me, cutting me off. He leans forward. I tense for the blow, but instead he snarls at me. Oi, you. You're a lying bitch. That's a message, cunt. You know who from. Almost casually, he bumps down the curb again, does a U-turn and pedals away. But not before he's made a stabbing gesture at me. Bitch, he shouts again, for good measure. Edward finds me huddled in the bedroom, sobbing. Without saying anything, he wraps me in his arms until I've stopped shaking enough to tell him what happened. He was probably just trying to frighten you, he says, when I've finished. Have you told the police? I nod tearfully. I'd phoned D.I. Clark as soon as I got back, leaving out only the bit about being called a liar. He said he'd get me some pictures of Nelson's associates to look at, but they'd almost certainly have used someone who wasn't known to the police. In the meantime, Emma, the D.I. had added, I'm giving you my private number. Text me any time you feel threatened. We'll fast-track a response, get someone out to you right away. Edward listens as I relay all this. So the police think it's just an attempt to intimidate you, meaning it would stop if you withdrew your evidence. I stare at him. You mean, if I let Nelson get away with it? I'm not necessarily suggesting that's what you should do, just that it's an option. If you want to be free of all this stress, you can put it all behind you and never think about Dion Nelson again. He strokes my hair tenderly, tucking a stray lock behind my ear. I'll make us something to eat, he says.
Now, Jane. I sit very still, My body turned to the window so that it catches the light. The only sound is the soft scratch of Edward's pencil as he sketches me. He has a leather-bound notebook he carries at all times, along with a steel rotary propelling pencil as heavy as a bullet. Sketching is what he does to relax. Sometimes he shows me the drawings. More often, though, he tears the page out with a sigh and takes it to the recycling bin built into the refectory counter. "What was wrong with that one?" I asked him one time.
"Nothing. It's a good discipline to throw away things you like but don't necessarily need. And a picture, any picture, left in view becomes invisible to the eye within minutes."
Once, that would have seemed a strange, even faintly comic thing to say, but I'm coming to understand him better now. And to some extent, I agree. So many things about this way of life that once seemed onerous are now habitual. These days, I slip my shoes off whenever I enter One Folgate Street's little hallway without a second thought. I arrange my spices in alphabetical order, just as he likes them, and find it no great hardship to put each one back in its rightful place after use. I fold my shirts and trousers according to the precise method of a Japanese guru who has written several books on the subject. Knowing Edward finds it hard to sleep if I use the bathroom after him, in case a towel has been left haphazardly on the floor, I spread them out after every shower and come back to deal with them when they're dry. Cups and plates are washed, dried, and put away within minutes of being used. Everything has its allotted space, and anything that can't be found such a place is probably redundant and should be jettisoned in any case. Our life together has acquired an efficient, calm serenity. A series of quiet domestic rituals soothing in and of themselves. There are compromises on his part, too. There are no bookshelves in the house, but he tolerates a neat stack of hardbacks in the bedroom so long as the edges are perfectly aligned and the construction four square. Only when the pile begins to tilt does he start frowning at it as he dresses. "Too high?"
"Perhaps a little, yes."
I still can't bring myself to throw books away, not even for recycling. But the charity shop on Hendon High Street is grateful for these pristine, almost unthumbed gifts. Edward rarely reads for pleasure. Once I asked him why, and he said it was to do with the words on facing pages not being symmetrical. "Is that a joke? I can never tell when you're joking."
"Perhaps 10% of a joke."
Sometimes when he sketches, he talks, or rather thinks out loud. And those are the most precious times of all. He doesn't like to be pressed about his past, but neither does he shy from it when it comes up in conversation. His mother was a disorganized, chaotic woman, I learn. Not exactly an alcoholic. Not exactly addicted to prescription pills. Another child might have had Edward's childhood and come out completely normal. But some sensitivity or contrary streak determined him down a different path. I talk in turn about my own parents, their relentless high standards, the hard-to-impress father who exhorted me by corporate email to try harder, do better, win more prizes. The habits of conscientiousness and diligence that have stayed with me all my life. We're complementary, we decide. We could neither of us settle for a partner who was happy being average. Now he finishes his sketch, studies it for a few moments, then turns the page without tearing it out. Am I a keeper this time?
For the time being.
Edward, I say.
Jane.
Some of the things we did in bed last night made me feel uncomfortable. He lines up another sketch, squinting at my legs over the point of the pencil.
"You seemed to enjoy them at the time," he says at last.
In the heat of the moment, perhaps. But afterward, I just wouldn't want that kind of thing to become a regular feature. That's all. He starts to draw, the pencil sweeping effortlessly across the page.
Why deny yourself something that gives you pleasure?
One can dislike something, even if doing it is a momentary indulgence, if it feels wrong. You of all people should understand that. The pencil's soft back and forth doesn't hesitate, like the stylus of a seismograph on a calm, earthquake-free day.
You're going to have to be more specific, Jane.
Rough stuff.
Go on.
Basically, anything that causes bruising, force, restraint, skin marks, or hair pulling, ditto. And while we're on the subject, you might as well know that I don't like the taste of cum, and anal is a complete no-no. The pencil stops.
Are you making rules for me?
I suppose I am. Yes. Boundaries, anyway. It goes two ways, of course, I add. Anything you want to say to me, feel free.
Only that you're a very remarkable woman.
He returns to his sketch, even if one of your ears is a little bigger than the other. Did she go along with it?
Who?
Emma. I know this is dangerous territory, but I can't help myself.
Go along with it, he repeats. An interesting way of putting it. But I never discuss my previous partners. You know that.
I'll take that as a yes.
You can take it any way you like, so long as you stop tapping your foot like that.
In my art history degree course, we did a module on palimpsests, medieval sheets of parchment so costly that, once the text was no longer needed, the sheets were simply scraped clean and reused, leaving the old writing faintly visible through the new. Later, Renaissance artists used the word pentimenti, repentances, to describe mistakes or alterations that were covered with new paint, only to be revealed years or even centuries later as the paint thinned with time, leaving both the original and the revision on view. Sometimes I have a sense that this house, our relationship in it, with each other, is like a palimpsest or a pentimento, that however much we try to overpaint Emma Matthews, she keeps tiptoeing back, a faint image, an enigmatic smile, stealing its way into the corner of the frame.
Then, Emma. Oh my God. Smashed glass litters the stone floor. My clothes are ripped. The sheets have come loose from the bed and been kicked into a corner. There's blood smeared across my thigh. I don't know where from. In the corner of the room is a broken bottle and some trodden food. Bits of me hurt that I don't even want to think about. We stare at each other like the two survivors of an earthquake or an explosion. Like we've been unconscious and we're just coming around. His eyes search my face. He looks appalled. He says, Emma, I... His voice trails off. I lost control, he says quietly. It's all right, I say. It's all right. I say it over and over, the way you'd soothe a runaway horse. We clutch at each other, exhausted, as if the bed is a raft and we found each other in a shipwreck. It wasn't only you, I add. It was such a small thing that prompted this. Since Edward moved in, I've been trying to keep things tidy, but sometimes that's meant chucking things in cupboards just a few minutes before he gets back. He opened a drawer and found it full of, I don't know, dirty plates or something. I told him it didn't matter. Tried to make him come to bed instead of dealing with them. And then, bam, he got angry. And I got the best sex I've ever had. I crawl into the warm bit between his arm and his chest and repeat the words I screamed at him not so long before. Yes, Daddy. Yes.
8. I try to do things well, even when others are not around to notice. Agree or disagree?
Now, Jane. I have to go away.
So soon? It's only been a few weeks since Edward moved in. We've been happy together. I know it in my heart. But I also know it from the metrics which Edward has been doing along with me. His aggregate is 58, mine a little higher at 65, but still a big improvement over where I started.
I'm needed on site. The planners are being difficult. They don't seem to understand. We're not going to complete the buildings and just hand them over for people to do what they like with. This was never about bricks and mortar. This is about building a new kind of community, one where people have responsibilities as well as rights.
This is the eco-town the partnership is building in Cornwall. Edward rarely talks about his work, but from what little he said, I've gathered New Austell has been a titanic struggle, not just because of the vast size of the commission, but because of all the fudges and shortcuts the developers have tried to force on him along the way. He suspects they only appointed him because of the lustre his name brought to a controversial planning application. Suspects, too, that it's exactly the same people who are now orchestrating a PR campaign against him, trying to put pressure on him to cram in more units, water down the rules, and thus make the whole thing more profitable. In the press, the idea of monk towns, austere communities of monastic simplicity, has become a standing joke. Do you remember what you said when you interviewed me? That I should talk to your clients about what it's like to live this way? I'd be happy to, if it would help.
Thank you, but I already have your data.
He holds up a sheaf of papers. Incidentally, Jane, housekeeper is showing that you've been looking for information about Emma Matthews.
Oh, perhaps once or twice, yes.
In fact, most of my nosying has been done at work or using the neighbor's Wi-Fi. But sometimes, late at night, I've been careless and used one Folgate Street's own internet.
Is that a problem?
It's just that I don't think any good can come of it. The past is over. That's why it's the past. Let it go, will you?
If you like.
I need you to promise. His tone is mild, but his eyes are steely.
I promise.
Thank you. He kisses my forehead. I'll be gone for a few weeks, maybe a little more, but I'll make it up to you when I'm back.
Then, Emma. At work, I look up Elizabeth Monkford and save the images to my desktop. I'm not surprised to discover his wife looked a bit like me. Men often go for the same type. Women do too, of course. It's just that in our case, it isn't usually physical resemblance so much as personality. Simon was an aberration, I now realize. The kind of men I'm really drawn to are men like Edward. Alpha men. I study the photographs carefully. Elizabeth Monkford had shorter hair than me. It gives her a slightly French, boyish look. I go into the ladies' room and stand in front of the mirror, pulling my bangs up with one hand and holding the rest of my hair around the back of my neck with the other, so it's out of sight. I like it, I decide. A touch of Audrey Hepburn, and it will show off the necklace. Wondering whether Edward will like it too makes me a little weak at the knees. If he hates it, if he's angry, at least I'll have provoked a reaction. And what if he's really angry? A voice inside my head whispers. Yes, please, Daddy. I turn my head this way and that. I like the way the star makes my neck look more delicate. Edward can wrap one hand around it. I can still see the marks left by his fingers from the other night. I'm still looking when Amanda comes in. She gives me a smile, but she looks tired and drawn. I let my hair fall back. Are you okay? I say. Not really, she goes. She splashes water on her face. The trouble with working at the same company as your husband, she says wearily, is that when it all goes balls up, there's no getting away from it. What's happened? Oh, the usual. He's been screwing around. Again. She starts to cry, yanking paper towels out of the dispenser to dab at her eyes. Has he said so? I don't need him to, she says. When I first slept with him, he was still married to Paula. I should have known he wasn't going to be faithful. She looks at herself in the mirror and attempts to repair the damage. He's been going to clubs with Simon, she says. But I suppose you already knew that. Since you two broke up, Saul's been hankering for bachelor freedom. It's funny, really, because Simon only ever goes on and on about getting back with you. She meets my eyes in the mirror. I don't suppose that's going to happen, is it? I shake my head. Shame. He adores you, you know. The problem was, I say, I got fed up with being adored, at least by someone as wet as Simon. What will you do about Saul? She shrugs despondently. Nothing, I suppose. Not yet, anyway. It's not like he's seeing someone. I'm pretty sure it's just one-night stands when he's had a few, probably proving to Simon he can still score too. At the thought of Simon sleeping with other women, I feel a sudden stab of jealousy. I push it away. He wasn't right for me. When are we going to meet Edward, anyway? She goes on. I'm dying to see if he's everything you say he is. Not for a while. He's going away tomorrow. This massive project he's got starting in Cornwall. Tonight's our last night. Got anything special planned? Sort of, I say. That is, I'm going to get my hair cut.
Now, Jane. It should feel different with Edward not here. But the truth is, the house is so much a part of him, I feel his presence even when he's away. It's nice, though, to be able to lay a book down while I cook, then simply pick it up again and read as I eat. Nice to have a fruit bowl on the refectory counter to graze from. Nice, too, to slouch around in a t-shirt and no bra, unfettered by the need to keep either myself or One Folgate Street pristine every single moment. He's left me 3 cutlery sets to try out. The Piano 98, designed by Renzo Piano, the Citerio 98, by Antonio Citerio, and the Caccia, by Luigi Caccia Dominioni and the Castiglioni brothers. I feel flattered to have been involved like this, but I suspect it's also a kind of test to see if my judgment coincides with his. Gradually, though, I become aware there's something niggling at me. Just as Edward can't ignore a left-out teaspoon or a stack of books that isn't perfectly aligned, so my tidy, conscientious mind refuses to leave alone the mystery of Emma Matthews's death. I do my best to resist it. After all, I promised. But the mental jarring only becomes more insistent. And what the promise he extracted from me failed to take into account is that this particular mystery is a barrier to our intimacy, to the quiet perfection of our life together. Really, what's the point of choosing precisely the right fork, and at the moment I'm favoring the weighty, sensuous curves of the piano, when there's this monstrous, messy shadow hanging over us from the past? The house wants me to know. I'm sure of it. If walls could talk, One Folgate Street would tell me what happened here. I will satisfy my curiosity, I decide, but secretly. And once I've laid those ghosts to rest, I will never wake them again. I won't ever speak to him of what I've learned. Carol Janssen described Edward as a narcissistic sociopath. So my first step is to research what that actually means. According to various psychology sites, a sociopath displays Superficial charm, a sense of entitlement, pathological lying. He or she is easily bored, manipulative, remorseless, lacking in emotional range. Individuals with narcissistic personality disorder believe themselves superior to others, insist on having the best of everything, are egocentric and boastful, fall in love easily, put the love object on a pedestal, then just as easily find fault. This is all wrong, I think. Yes, Edward is different from other people, but from a sense of purpose, not superiority. His self-confidence is never boastful or attention-seeking, nor do I think he ever lies. Integrity is very, very important to him. The first list might be closer, but it still doesn't feel right. Edward's reserve, his unavailability, could certainly be taken as evidence that he's lacking in emotional range, but actually, I don't think he is. Having lived with him, if only for a short while, it's more that he's, I think, searching for the right words. It's more like he's closed off, that he's been hurt in the past and has reacted by retreating behind these self-erected barriers into a perfect, ordered world of his own devising. Was it his childhood? Was it the death of his wife and child? Could it even have been the death of Emma?